This is the Changing Behavior Network. On this site, it is our aim to foster and support emotional and behavioral well-being in our young people. I'm Dr. James Sutton, psychologist and your host. Welcome to today's feature. Enjoy and share it with others. The practice of raising responsible, self-reliant children and teens can be a challenge at times, and it seems practice is the right word. But the challenge becomes more difficult when, as parents, we attempt to tackle the job with only three tools in our toolbox: telling, reminding, and yelling. Truth is, just about every parent has learned, most likely the hard way, that a reliance on three tools only too often does not bring the outcomes they want regarding discipline and behavior. Have you ever thought, there's got to be a better way? Well, there is. Our guest on this program, Greg Warburton, will share with us what he calls a paradigm shift, a different perspective for adding more and more effective tools to that toolbox. For instance, Greg will share how practice of asking instead of telling can empower kids and teens to consider and reflect on ways they can address problem behaviors themselves. Result, more problems solved and much better relationships. And that's just for starters, so join us for other great ideas and approaches for achieving self-reliance and better, more empowering outcomes. Greg Warburton is a licensed mental health counselor who helps youngsters and parents become instruments of their own healing and change. He is a dedicated innovator who brings emotional and mental self-management methods into the world of parenting and sport performance. As an award-winning college instructor, he helps people eliminate self-defeating behaviors and achieve the inner freedom that comes with becoming self-reliant. We're featuring Greg's new book, Ask More, Tell Less, A Practical Guide for Helping Children Achieve Self-Reliance. Greg, welcome to the Changing Behavior Network.
Good morning, Jim. I appreciate very much the opportunity to visit with you.
Listen, this book has 49 chapters. You made me work on this one. You talk about an emphasis on down-to-earth and practical methods in this book for addressing inappropriate behavior, and you do believe you have a different approach that stands out from others. Tell us about that, Greg.
Yes, over the last 30 years of working in mental health and sitting with kids and teens and parents, my intention has always been to provide what I call real help right now. And what that means is I have to be able to produce and create effective methods that become simple and usable, immediately usable by the parents and the kids and teens. So that's what I've done, is I've taken time-tested behavior methods from the behind the counselor's door, bringing them to the parent public in an attempt to help parents build a collection of skills for boosting esteem, self-reliance, and effectively managing troubling behavior.
Excellent. And tell us a little bit what you mean by self-reliance, because in your book you apply that not only to youngsters but to parents as well. So what would that mean, self-reliance?
Self-reliance, simply defined, is developing that inner knowing, inner knowledge that I can handle life on my own if I must. And so the intention of creating questions as a way to cause people, adults and children, to progressively do more of their own thinking, listening, remembering, and deciding all along the pathway.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more, and about the questions and how they're asked and why they're important. But what do you see typically as some of the more common issues that get in the way of youngsters learning self-reliance, or parents even being able to share that the way they would want to?
Well, to use a now perhaps trite phrase in the parenting world, is the idea, and certainly it's well-founded in our modern world, but the idea of helicopter parents, or parents thinking and doing too much for their children, in part to keep them safe and also in part because they're not sure what else to do. So what I'm teaching about is the how-to aspect of moving children into a self-reliant practice.
Right. Well, you also talk about, too, is, and this is easy for, to happen, is for parents to begin over-focusing on problem behavior and really not noticing when the youngsters are being more appropriate. I used to say whenever I was doing training, that's when we want to rest, but when kids are doing well, that's when we need to work the hardest.
Thank you. Actually, that's so true, and I actually have a very short chapter, and there are a lot of chapters in the book, and at the same time, they're short on purpose.
Right. But
one chapter is just titled Shift from Don't to Do.
Right.
Meaning, if I could get every parent on the planet to pay more attention to how their children are behaving in ways that they want them to behave, and highlighting and being excited and praising them for that.
Right.
That puts them on a different pathway right from the start.
Well, you have a triangle in your book, too, that you call the self-reliant parent. And the points on the triangle are listen to understand. Listen to understand first. And because, you know, sometimes, well, this is my interpretation, Greg. Sometimes what a youngster does makes sense when you give them a chance to explain why they did something. It might not be appropriate, but to the youngster in the moment, it seemed to be the right thing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And that's why I write about and have a little mantra that I use with parents in the face of behavior trouble or troubling behavior.
Right.
More aptly said, practice curiosity before control.
Right. Right.
For example, you've got a child who says, I'm dumb or I'm stupid or I can't learn. A parent might go into feeling pressured to figure out the just right thing to do or say, and it may sound something like, no, you're not. You can do a lot of things, and you're smart.
Exactly.
I don't want you to keep saying those things about yourself. You know you won't ever do well thinking that way. Besides, I don't like seeing you so upset, so stop talking that way.
Yeah, and, you know, and the point about that is that I think it's natural for parents and teachers too to say, "Well, you're smart. You're not stupid." But in asking the youngster why they think that might really give you some insights into how you're going to manage the situation. It's critical.
And yes, and even before asking why, I'd invite the listeners, your listeners, to feel the shift. If I shift from giving a short speech, as I tease about,
right,
to a question like, how much longer do you plan to practice believing you're stupid?
Right. Right.
Feel the shift from pressure on parents to figure out just what to say, and it effectively handed to the child to think with you in the moment of the question.
Well, my guess is the first time you do this, you shock them right out of their socks. They're not ready for that question. But that's good.
Noticing that. Then we talk about what to do when we're asking what I call quality questions, which are simple and precise and direct and thought-provoking.
Right, right.
What to do, because you may get a few more I don't know answers or shoulder shrugs or sighs or
exactly
ground looking, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. When I was reading your book, there I came across something that reminded me of something my son told me, and I think this was his first year in college, and he came home, Greg, and said to me, Dad, I hope this doesn't upset you, but I have decided that if anything were to happen to you, I'm still going to be okay. And I told him, I said, that's what every parent wants to hear at some point, is that...
Absolutely.
Yeah. And actually, it felt good hearing him say that.
Yes, I get your point there, and congratulations in that sense of that's that inner knowing.
Right, right, right. I wanted you to talk about your getting on with growing up questions, and you share these early in the book, and this is another example of asking them questions, but also giving them this issue of empowerment by letting them make a choice from a small menu that you provide them. Would you go through those with us? Because I think they're very creative.
Certainly. When I'm beginning sitting with children and parents, or in the beginning, I want to get a sense of how they are able to or are not able to think for themselves. So I typically ask three questions. With younger children, I would ask the question, are you the kind of kid who can get on with growing up, or will you grow down, Mark? And are you the kind of kid who likes to think for themselves, or do you let others think for you? And have you made up your own mind? Do you want to be the boss of your own life, or do you want others to run your life for you or boss you? The phrase, the dilemma phrase, growing up or growing down, has been very useful over the years. With teenagers, you simply change the language. If growing up or growing down is a bit too corny or childish, then I would ask a teenager the same question, different language, and that is, are you the kind of teen who plans to drive your own life, or will you be a passenger in life?
Excellent, excellent approach. And what you do is something that therapist friend of mine in Virginia, Dr. Doug Riley, calls splitting the universe. You offer them two choices, but the choices you offer them give them a chance to reflect on what's going on and really what they want out of all of this, whether it's a visit with you or resolving an issue or a problem with a parent or a teacher or anything else. And I like those questions and where they could take you. I wanted to make a comment also, Doug is good at doing this. He says if he has a young child in his office, he says, are you a big boy or a big girl? And they always say yes, even if they're 3 years old, you know, because they want to be growing up.
Absolutely.
And that's important to them. I like your use of paradox, too, and I don't completely remember the context, but the question was, how long a speech can you listen to now? Share that, because I thought that was creative.
Well, the intention there is when you are talking with children and teens, you want to generate an environment where you have a curious listener. And we all know that teens know their parents' adult speeches pretty well, some almost word for word. They've heard it a billion times. So creative way to get to say what you want to say is to put a finite timeline on your speech. Quote, speech, and honor it. And so I simply ask, sometimes if there's something I really want them to hear, I'll let them know that I'm getting ready to tell them something I really hope they hear, and I will only speak for 1 minute. Or I might ask them how, or whether they can handle a 1 minute speech or a 2 minute speech. And then I honor the timeline.
Honor that timeline, and I've done a similar thing where I have a youngster in the office and I'll tell them, and I really have set it up for a very short session, which, you know, insurance doesn't like that, but we work it out. And I would say, you know, I only have a couple of minutes and I need to be out of here. I'll catch you at another time, as if I were seeing a youngster in the school, for instance. And I would say, but let me visit with you, for 2 minutes or 3 minutes. And that way the youngster knows, as difficult or as uncomfortable as this might be for them, there is a time limit on it. And that's part of what you're saying too, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So that
they know there's a beginning and an ending.
Right, right. And I usually turn them so they can see the clock if they want to.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
time it.
But that's a good question. And my guess is when they say, "Yeah, I can handle a minute," my guess is they're going to listen to it more carefully than if you didn't preface it that way.
They do, and then the curious result sometimes is you honor the timeline in the middle of your quote speech.
Okay.
And all of a sudden they want to hear the rest of it.
How about that? Yeah. In other words,
it's a playful, engaging way to have clear communication.
Sure. But it's also a way for them to learn you're going to keep a promise.
Absolutely.
And that's important because they want to know if they could trust you. Yeah.
We're talking about dignity and respect both directions.
Absolutely, absolutely. Talk a little bit about what you call mindful presence when you use the questions and the quality questions. We'll talk about those in a minute. What do you mean by mindful presence? Because mindfulness is a big thing right now.
It is a big thing. And the true listener can only understand what's going on if they're kind of mind, body, spirit, or mentally, emotionally in the moment. When I use the word quality, and you look it up in the definition, in Webster, it implies care and attention. attention. That you, there's a mindful presence that you're genuinely seeking to be informed by your child about how they're thinking and deciding to run their lives in the way they have been. So being mindful is, again, also listening to understand. It's just putting yourself in the present moment, tending to truly listen.
What's interesting about that is that's very effective. I have a friend out in California, Dr. Marv Marshall, who uses a similar concept. He calls them reflective questions. But one of the things he has to explain pretty often, and you mentioned in your book too, is that sometimes other adults see this as a too permissive approach, but it's really not. I wish you would address that.
Absolutely. That is one of the concerns, is am I giving control to my children to their detriment? And absolutely not. This is actually right. The most challenging thing you can do, because you're challenging them to practice thinking and deciding for themselves.
Sure.
So it's not a cater to the children's approach. And the other aspect is that the asking questions foundation and positioning is only one piece of that parent triangle that I talk about.
Right.
We also must have not only the listening and the vigilant praise, but skilled limit setting as well. So there are times if the child is not engaging in a dialogue through questions, then adults may change the rules, so to speak, and be directing and telling them more intentionally.
Right, and I was thinking this morning, Greg, as I was setting up the interview, just kind of adding to what you're saying there, is I so often hear school counselors say things like, I do a lot of work with schools, and
yeah.
You know, the common thing is when you ask a youngster what's wrong, 99% of the time their answer is nothing. Because, you know, really, they're uncomfortable, and they probably make the counselor uncomfortable in the process. So the quality of the question makes a tremendous amount of difference in how you're going to get into the issue so that the youngster can feel empowered to change them for themselves.
Certainly does.
Well, in your book on page 50 and 51, you go through a lot of benefits of quality questions. Could you give us an example of some quality questions?
Yes, I consider the dilemma questions we've mentioned already, the kind of kid who will grow up or
right.
down, as a quality question. But the intention is that, and the key to knowing about questions is that for humans, our mind instantly goes to answering the questions that you're asking. So earlier you mentioned the what's wrong question.
Right.
Whether the child admits it or not, then we're focused on only what's wrong, and we forget there's right things going on.
Good point.
So the quality questions are not about why, but they're about what and how.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, instead of why don't you show more respect for people, I might ask what does a person get from being respectful? Or I've learned that to break questions down so they're answerable, more answerable, so when children succeed answering a first question, they'll answer a second question. So
good point.
It's useful to break questions down into pieces. So I often am asking, what's one thing a person gets from being respectful?
My guess, too, Greg, is... I'm sorry.
Responsibility. Or what is one thing you will do to start taking responsibility for your behavior?
Ah, very good. Very good. My guess is, and every therapist, counselor who's ever worked with a youngster for the first time, the child or that teen is kind of on guard. They don't know who you are. But when they see you asking these questions and they perceive you're really looking for ways to help them and find some answers to those, my experience has been they warm up pretty quickly.
They do indeed. And the other piece I would add to that is I take no pro-social or positive behavior for granted.
Right.
So if a child comes through my door and sits down to have a conversation, I can be impressed. If they're playing in the waiting room and I'm interrupting their play and asking them to now come meet with me, that is a praise moment, or thank you for letting letting me interrupt. Did you notice what you just did? Get on with growing up.
Good point. And the reason why I think that's important is I think it's important to recognize the small steps, because a lot of times the kids themselves don't see them.
They do not, right?
And that's very important.
Grace.
Yeah. You work in sport performance also, and those small steps, sometimes youngsters, they get frustrated because they're not doing it as perfectly as they want to do. And it's the same thing with academics. A lot of kids just don't see that they're making progress. And yet when you break it down and show them they actually are, you see that smile come on their face that they realize that they are a little further down the road than they thought they were.
Yes, and we get, when we're focused on the troubling behavior, we get in mode, parent and child, teacher and student,
mm-hmm.
of waiting for the big final result. And there's nothing that's done or said until that happens, and then if it doesn't happen, we have a problem.
How do you deal with responses like, I don't know, or sometimes the answer you get to what's wrong and they say nothing? How do you handle those kinds of situations? I suppose you would put a question behind it.
Actually, I do want people to know that those are not impenetrable barriers.
Right.
There are ways through. If I'm asking quality questions, one of the most useful things to do with an I don't know response is to normalize it.
Right.
So if I ask a question that I think is a good question, like, are you the kind of kid who's getting on with growing up or growing down? And they say, I don't know. I can say, I know you don't know. Let's think about it together. It takes some time to think through that and make the decision. So I can make it normal to say, I don't know. Or I can be curious about the life result of practicing I don't knows or shoulder shrugs or silence by being curious with a question. If they happen to notice, does saying I don't know a lot and not talking, being silent, shrugging your shoulders help kids grow up or grow down?
Right.
Or for teens, does it help teens drive their own life or be a passenger in life?
Good point.
And connect. The other key here is connecting moment-by-moment behavior with result in their life by framing a question to challenge them to think ahead.
And obviously learning how to ask those quality questions means answering questions that don't require a yes or no answer, but really some type of development of an answer. One of the questions I used to ask sometimes, or a statement, I guess, I would say to a youngster, tell me more about that. You know, to encourage them to elaborate. And generally it worked pretty well.
Intending to open up conversation.
Right. Talk about fine-tuning timeouts. I thought your approach here was excellent. Because most of the time, timeouts, you go sit over there for 20 minutes, but that's not what you talk about. And it's an excellent approach. Share that with our listeners.
Certainly. What I discovered is that the timeout strategy, parents would often say, I've tried it. It doesn't work.
Right.
Started to frame the language. It's a useful tool to keep in your toolbox. It's a logical social consequence of a child being disrespectful toward people or property that they have time away and lose that privilege. So fine-tuning timeout for me meant, one, simplifying it in what I call down-to-earth practice, and that is they only letting the child know they only have two jobs, and that is to admit what they did without blaming anyone else and convince me in the truest sense of the word what you'll do differently. And, oh, by the way, I don't want to just hear I won't do it again.
Right.
We're not connecting. The purpose of timeout and behavior change is not serving time in the corner.
And when a youngster can do those two things, the timeout's over.
And then there it puts them in a little bit of control and
Right. Parents. Excellent point.
Has some pressure off themselves.
You also talk about celebrating success. I love the story of the big paper where you're writing down something that this young girl had achieved, and you're going to write it down. She wants you to put it on a large chart paper, and she wants to take it home with her. So for kids, that's important. Celebrating and recognizing that I did well and making it big, that's an important part.
Yeah, and I have learned the phrase years ago about freezing the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's so important. And then not so long ago, I'm reading Dr. Rick Hansen's book, Hardwiring Happiness. Have you seen that book?
No, I haven't.
But anyway, the key point he makes is that because the human brain has a negativity bias, that if we, in those moments, big paper for big moments of growing up, is a way to freeze the moment and keep the child in that place, kind of thinking and feeling it for another 5 to 10 seconds, which helps new neural pathways form in the brain, quite literally.
Excellent. Excellent. And one other thing you talk about, making appointments. I thought this was interesting. You tell me, I don't have time to deal with the situation now, but let's meet at a time, and then would you go through that behavior again and show it to me? And then they begin to they begin to catch the paradox there and probably don't want to do it.
Yeah, they rarely not want to practice. And the key there, though, is I do not present that. The key is to be non-judgmental and not sarcastic.
Right, exactly.
It's a genuine exploration and a challenge for them to perform the behavior on purpose so they can decide whether they want to keep the behavior or change it.
Good point. Good point. Greg, how can folks get a copy of your book?
My book is available on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. There's a Kindle book and a print book version. And on Amazon, I know there's a good look inside the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. And your website?
Also available on my new website, uh-huh, which is live now, selfreliantkids.com.
We'll post that.
All one word, selfreliantkids.com.
We'll post that, and you have a free offer of an article that we'll post as a PDF with this interview, and it's called Revisiting the Power of Praise, the Full Formula, and they can just click on that, and that will also have some more information about you and your work. And also, Greg, for the first 5 listeners who purchase your book and contact you, you're offering some free consultation by Skype, by phone.
Correct.
That's,
I would look forward to that.
And that's a good deal. That's a good deal. Well, gosh, as usual, the time flew by, and it generally does. A lot of ideas, and I just want the listeners to understand, we have just touched the very tip of the iceberg. 49 chapters, and every one of them was loaded with lots of great ideas. So I strongly recommend this book. Greg, I'm going to back out of here and let you close for us and just say thank you so much for being with us today on the Changing Behavior Network. Take us out.
Thank you, Jim. I want listeners to know that these are time-tested methods brought from behind the counselor's door to the parent public. They help parents set the stage for children and teens to progressively do more of their own thinking, talking, listening, remembering, relating, and deciding in regard to how they're running their lives.
These recordings can be found at the ChangingBehaviorNetwork.com.